At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Stock markets are shaky, but hanging on. Millions of people still don't have jobs. Shoppers are spending and then they're saving. So today on the broadcast, the latest episode of What the Heck is Going On Here? From American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Novo Nordisk. Since 1923, innovative developer of diabetes treatments and delivery devices at novonordisk-us.com. And by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, everybody, the 11th of June, and it is good to have you here. The particulars of today's episode of Economic Problem Solving are these. First, there was a survey out this morning from Thomson Reuters and the University of Michigan that said consumer sentiment, basically how optimistic we are about the economy, is near a 2.5-year high. Also out today, though, data from the Commerce Department showing retail sales fell for the first time since Thanksgiving. We asked Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith to connect the dots.
Consumers are feeling confident, but they're barely spending. They're confidently scrimping.
Incredibly difficult to analyze. I've never seen things like this.
Britt Beamer heads up America's research group. He's been studying consumer behavior for more than 30 years.
Consumers really have what might be described as an apple cart upset in their heads.
Beamer says people are feeling better about their jobs, but worse about the economy in general. Better about gas prices, but worse about their long-term financial futures. And all this means, when it comes to spending money, consumers have a serious case of the Scarlett O'Haras.
Where shall I go? What shall I do?
And economists say we should give a darn. Here's PNC Wealth Management's Bill Stone.
Every recovery we've ever looked at in the United States has seen the consumer come back before employment. So we saw the consumer start to spend, frankly, before you saw any good news on the employment front.
Economist Julia Coronado with BNP Paribas says bipolar data like this is a good sign.
Often when we're at a turning point in the economy, the data get very noisy. There's a lot of bouncing around.
Coronado says consumers do feel better, and now they're reassessing how much they save and spend and how much credit they have.
I do think we have a new consumer. Consumers are much more cautious in their spending. They're cautiously optimistic.
Coronado says people will start shopping again when they have a better handle on their own situations and other parts of the economy settle down.
I can't think about this now. I'll go crazy if I do. I'll think about it tomorrow.
After all, tomorrow is another day and another economic indicator. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
In what seems like case number 500,392 of Investors versus the banks, we turn our attention to Merrill Lynch. The firm, which is now owned by Bank of America, is being sued by ordinary investors, actually wealthy ordinary investors, who lost millions of dollars after buying some complex pools of mortgages that went bad. Those pools are said to have contained some of the lowest graded mortgages in Merrill's portfolio. And the people who bought them were allowed to because they were considered sophisticated investors. That term and what it means is more important than you might think, as Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
To be considered a sophisticated investor, you need a lot of money. $5 million in the case of the Merrill Lynch investments.
People who are not sophisticated in the way the investment world works are wrongly classified.
That's Ted Eppenstein, a securities fraud lawyer here in New York. He says just because a bank is dealing with someone who ought to know what he or she is doing doesn't give it the right to sell a package of extreme risk without full disclosure.
We've represented a dentist from Italy, funeral home directors in New York, a cookie salesman from France, all in cases against Merrill Lynch. So you can come from a very broad range of background, you can be well educated, and you can still be taken by the pitch of the salesman.
In fact, many of the nation's top financial minds have admitted they don't understand these collateralized debt obligations. Then again, no one forced these so-called sophisticated investors to buy anything. Business litigator Mark Zouderer says both sides share some blame.
The sophisticated investor has a higher degree of responsibility to make judgments about the quality of the investment. But you have to ask yourself, what is an investor to do when the brokerage firm's not disclosing, if that happened, some of the risks that are not highlighted in the material?
Merrill Lynch says each of its investors signed a short document saying they understood the risks involved. Still, Congress may raise the bar for who has access to the riskiest investments in its new financial reform bill. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, climbing into the close and also into the weekend. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Of medical entrepreneurship offers us this vision of the future. Buy a $100 kit at a local pharmacy. Send off a sample of your saliva. Get your own personal genetic profile back, complete with information about which disease or condition you might be susceptible to. Walgreens got a lot of attention a couple of weeks ago when it said it would start selling those kits. And then just as quickly, it said it wouldn't after questions were raised about the safety and effectiveness and overall wisdom of that idea. Today, the FDA stepped in. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Gregory Warner reports.
The FDA sent letters to five companies saying that direct-to-consumer genetic tests are now considered medical devices and are subject to regulation by the agency. At issue is whether these tests are delivering medical information. Jesse Reynolds is with the Center for Genetics and Society in Berkeley, California. He says tests promise to tell you how you might respond to certain drugs or what's your risk for certain cancers.
But they've thus far avoided regulation by claiming in their fine print to be educational or recreational in purpose.
One company called 23andMe responded in a statement that, yes, its tests are for research and education only. Another company, Pathway, already stepped out of the consumer market because of FDA pressure. Daniel Carpenter is a professor of government at Harvard. He wrote a book about the FDA.
You know, if you go into the hospital and you get a test there, they regulate those tests as medical devices already.
The market for genetic testing is exploding. Lab fees for genetic tests are expected to exceed $6 billion this year. Dan Vorhaus edits the blog Genomics Law Report. He says regulating over-the-counter tests will stifle innovation and raise prices.
What we need right now is better transparency, not more regulation.
But regulation could end up helping the companies involved. Walgreens and CVS Caremark have said they won't put the kits on their shelves until the FDA gives its blessing. There's still just one genetics test you can buy at Rite Aid, a paternity test. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
The easy thing to do right now to set up our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond would be to say something about BP and all the trouble it's in. We did that last week. So even though BP is still in trouble, we are going to do something else. Here to help with whatever that turns out to be are Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine, also Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. Good to talk to you both again.
Good to be with you, Kai.
Good to be here, Kai.
So I'm going to riff off the top of the broadcast a little bit. Stacey Vanek Smith was talking about consumers and how they're not really sure what's going on. The question to you, Lee, is companies and larger institutional traders. Wall Street's looking pretty good. What's the vibe?
Well, it's funny. I mean, I think we're in this stage of such volatility. You know, there's still crazy roller coaster rides happening in Europe. Back here, you know, there are still signs that the recovery is underway. If you look at a lot of the indicators, although, you know, we did see a negative indicator from retail sales this week, and there's still the jobs picture. But I think there's just a lot of uncertainty in the markets. From a company standpoint, you know, companies have lots of cash on their balance sheets, and profits are huge. But I think there's just it's all about psychology right now, and nobody quite knows what's going
to
happen.
So, Deep, let me get to the politics of this for a second. I wasn't actually going to go here, but let's take a little detour. The jobs bill that is sitting in Congress, is there enough economic unease in Washington to get that jobs bill passed?
There is as much political unease as there is economic unease, and with the elections coming up, the Democrats in particular know they have to do everything they possibly can to make it seem like they're trying to, they're at least dealing with the economy. The problem is there's so little that can be done to actually fix this problem without creating new ones. The Fed has done just about everything that it can, pushing its credibility to the limit. And the White House knows that if you were to go and do another big jobs bill, whose benefit would be perhaps limited and questionable, then you're going to create an additional budget problem and raise more concerns about this U.S. Debt and deficit that's already too high, and then bring some of those problems and those doubts about European fiscal conditions to back to the U.S. and exacerbate our own situation. And so how you deal with that problem, you're kind of in a box if you're a policymaker without very many tools to deal with it.
Yeah. Lee, speaking of European debt and the problems over there, you were just, I understand, at a conference with a lot of economists from Europe, and we've talked a lot about how we're seeing their problems. How do they see their problems?
Well, they're really in the thick of it still. I would say one trend that came away is just there's a really different view of regulation in Europe, especially from the regulators themselves. I mean, one person at the Conference of Montreal, which is where I was the head of BaFin, which is Germany's financial regulator, which a few weeks ago came out and banned naked short selling. So it was very controversial, but they're adamant that this needs to be done. There's a lot more talk of global cooperation, the thinking being, well, okay, if the U.S. passes reform, what good is it if the global banks don't have to adhere to that? And so there was a lot more talk about that. There was talk about too big to fail being unacceptable, which is different from the take we've adapted here. So it's very different.
This is great, actually. You guys are feeding me really good segues, because now I'm going to turn around. I'm going to go back to Sudeep in Washington about financial reform. The bill is going to be negotiated starting on Tuesday. Any big surprises, or is it going to be, as many have thought, Sudeep, the Senate bill by and large?
Well, it starts with the Senate bill, but it's probably going to be a pretty bloody fight. And this has already been such an epic process, but there are still a lot of important disagreements remaining. And most interesting in all of this are these kind of diverging forces here. The Obama administration knows the public is angry and they want action after this financial crisis and recession. And their goal is to get a bill out. But you also have to remember that there are lobbyists who are continuing to work pretty hard on this. And if you remember that grade school Schoolhouse Rock video, "I'm just a bill, yes, I'm only a bill." Well, they don't mention in that video what happens when you have 2,500 lobbyists from the financial sector all jumping into the process. That's five for every lawmaker, by the way. And you have disagreements about how to structure this new Consumer Financial Protection Agency, how to deal with derivatives, those messy financial instruments. One measure would lead to spinning them off. And these are meaty debates that the public may not be following as closely, but they're probably going to lead to a pretty heated debate in the conference committee before we actually see the end of this in a few weeks.
Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal in Washington, D.C. Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine in New York. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, we were just talking about financial regulation and the conference committee meetings that are going to start on Tuesday between House and Senate negotiators. Big banks, credit rating agencies, insurance companies, they are all trying to figure out what the new rules are going to be. High-flying hedge funds are what you might call an interested party as well. They had a great 2009, got back a lot of their losses from 2008, in fact. So if hedge funds still make money, maybe hedge fund managers, might be good people to ask about financial advice. That's the thought that occurred to the comedy sketch group Hot Mess from the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater.
It's time here at Marketplace for our segment, Ask a Hedge Fund Manager. We're taking your calls, and Dan Etter, you're here to help. You're a fund manager at a powerful New York City hedge fund, right?
That's right, and I'm ready to handle all your questions. Allison's our first caller. Allison?
Hi, Dan. I have a fixed-rate 30-year mortgage. You know, I usually budget enough to pay interest, but I'm thinking of paying off the principal quicker. Any thoughts on how I would do that?
And why don't you just buy the house?
Excuse me?
And why don't you just put cash down on the house and buy it when you saw it?
I can't.
Oh, I gotcha. Too busy playing squash to show your face at the realtor. I hear you. Just get an assistant to deliver the cash.
Okay.
Okay. Jill, you're on.
Hi. I have about $10,000 in credit card debt, and I want to know if I should open a new line of credit with a lower APR.
What's that?
What, APR?
No, the thing before that.
Credit card debt?
Yeah. What is that?
I'm sorry. Do you not know what credit card debt is?
Just pay it off.
I can't. I don't have $10,000.
Seriously?
Yes.
You got problems.
I know. That's why I called.
Good luck with all that. Next caller?
Hi. This isn't really financial, but I like this girl, and I'm wondering how to impress her.
Yeah, how big is your boat?
I don't have a boat.
You don't have a boat? Get a boat.
I can't really afford a boat.
Boat.
I just got laid off, so...
Get a boat, lady.
I'm a man. You're really out of touch.
You're killing me here. A boat is only like $2 or $3 million. It's couch change.
I'm not going to argue with you. I just don't have that kind of money.
Well, get it.
I don't know how to.
I'm hanging up. He doesn't have a boat? What does he jump his motorcycle onto?
I have no idea. Thanks, Dan. Always great to get financial advice from the perspective of a hedge fund manager.
Yeah, sure. Does this roof have a helipad?
No.
Hot Mess is Allison Becker, Jill Donnelly, Dan Etter, Josh Ratchford, and Leslie Tsina. If you haven't seen the Upright Citizens Brigade take off on the BP oil spill, by the way, their conference table coffee spill that's gone viral online, you really ought to. It's actually fabulous. There's a link on our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, the bittersweet seduction of buying a house.
Then he started saying all the, you know, pluses to owning, and me and my wife started discussing it. You know, she was very weary about it at first, but, you know, I talked her into it. You know, dumb me.
But first, let's do the numbers. Those weak retail sales numbers kept things quiet most of the trading day, but a rush of buying at the end pushed the markets into positive territory. The Dow Industrials put on 38 points this Friday, 0.3%, closed at 10,211. The Nasdaq bumped up 24 points, that is 1.1%, 2243 at the bell. The S&P 500 gained 4 points, 0.4%, finished at 1,091. For the week gone by, the Dow rose 2.8%, the Nasdaq up 1.1%. The S&P 500 edged up 0.4%. Consumer goods companies mostly struggled today. Procter & Gamble washed away 1.5%. Coca-Cola drained down 0.2%. Kraft sliced off 0.25%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.23%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, helping doctors, lawyers, and small business owners monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. ReputationDefender.com/market. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune in to Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on manufacturing, mining, and wholesale trade for the first quarter. A Flag Day ceremony takes place at the National Air Force Memorial in Arlington, Virginia. Andy says, "You're fired," on TV. Real estate developer and reality TV star Donald Trump turns 64. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's students who worry the most, anyway, about getting into college. It is usually their parents, though, who worry about paying for it. With tuitions mounting every year and the economy just barely coming up for air, the financial stress is only getting higher. And commentator Kim Clark says the government is making it worse.
If only financial aid was more like Cocoa Puffs. Cereal makers have to list their ingredients and obey truth in labeling and advertising laws. But most financial aid programs aren't covered by those laws. Take state college savings plans. Oregon recently settled with Oppenheimer funds, which had packed that state's ultra-conservative college savings plan with so many risky derivatives that it lost about half of its value. Or so-called guaranteed college savings plans. These savings plans guarantee parents who pay for tuition today that the plan will cover tuition in the future. But look at what's behind those guarantees. In Maryland, for example, if the fund can't earn enough to match tuition, the fund is guaranteed to ask the legislature for a bailout. Then there's the TEACH grant, which was created to encourage students to become teachers. Great idea. But Congress attached so many strings that the grants turned into basically forgivable loans. The odds of having to repay those grants with interest are so high that many college financial aid officials will not process students' applications. Perhaps the cruelest joke of all is the expected family contribution. That's the amount the government calculates families can afford to pay for tuition. But these days, about 98% of colleges do not have enough financial aid to ensure that every student's family only has to pay its EFC. And most low- and middle-income families typically have to pay their EFC plus another $5,000. Politicians, bureaucrats, and colleges are raising people's hopes with financial aid programs that promise more than they deliver. Maybe we don't have the money to give every student all the aid they need, but we ought to at least give them the truth.
Kim Clark covers money and education for U.S. News and World Report. Take a second to send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Say this for the American dream, it has got staying power. The belief that owning a home is financially better than renting is still amazingly strong, even in the face of statistics like the one we got yesterday. Almost 94,000 families had their homes repossessed last month. That's about as good a lesson as you'll ever get, that chasing the dream can go very wrong very quickly. From WBUR in Boston, Kurt Nickisch reports.
They thought they were laying the foundation for a life of prosperity. 4 years ago, Calvin and Atiyah Sangster bought a condominium in Boston's rundown Mattapan neighborhood.
By the time we started finding out, you know, a lot of things about the street, you know, it was kind of too late. We was already there.
Things like the man who squatted in the foyer of their building. Addicts rang their doorbell.
Do you have a dollar? Do you have $2? You know.
One day, Atiyah's wedding ring was stolen. But none of that compared to the summer day when they had their windows open. Atiyah and Calvin saw two people arguing right outside on the sidewalk.
They just started fighting, they were tussling, and once he had a guy on the ground, he pulled out the gun and just started shooting him with it.
Where was your daughter at the time?
She was actually laying right in that room. And that's where it was like, okay, we can't keep her up here anymore, you know. I can't wait to get off of the street.
Now Calvin wonders why they were in such a hurry to get on this street, why they were in such a hurry to buy. Their first child was a boy, Calvin Jr., CJ. When he was born, they were renting from Calvin's grandmother. She lived on the next floor, his mom around the corner.
I was very content.
The couple was planning to buy someday, but they had it good. A big two-bedroom apartment for $800 a month. That's cheap in Boston. Calvin was training to be a union electrician, and Atiyah was working. They were putting money away. Not bad for a 23-year-old dad and a 20-year-old mom. Then, one day, Calvin's good friend came over, CJ's godfather. Calvin remembers how this friend had just become a realtor.
And he was like, well, the mortgage probably won't even be too much more than how much you're paying now? And I'm like, really? You know, that's where I started kind of getting drawn in. Then he started saying all the, you know, pluses to owning, and me and my wife started discussing it. You know, she was very weary about it at first, but, you know, I talked her into it. You know, dumb me.
The condo seemed nice. $170,000 seemed like a good deal. Once they moved into the condo, things started falling apart.
The house is, like, settling. See, like, the house is kind of slanted this way. Because the floor became uneven, the tiles started cracking.
Calvin and Atiya were paying $700 more to live here than in their old apartment, almost twice as much, and then many thousands more in repairs and renovations. Appliances crapped out, doors wouldn't close, mold bloomed in the bathroom. 2 years in, their interest rate jumped. Calvin and Atiya refinanced to get a fixed payment. Now they owed more, $190,000. But they were still hanging on to a dream they knew so well but didn't understand, the dream of homeownership. Financially, they were making it work. Calvin's pay had almost doubled when he finished his training as an electrician. As long as he kept his job, everything would be fine.
My foreman comes and, Calvin, I need to talk to you. And I'm just like, I don't believe it. I knew what was coming, you know, because he never talks to me. So.
Getting laid off meant there was no money coming in, only going out. Month after month, one thought kept coming back to Calvin. Just how much cash they'd have in the bank if they'd just kept renting from his grandmother. That vanished number amazes him still today. He figures it's about $80,000. And it pains him, too, because $80,000 happens to be about all his condo is worth today, not even half of what he owes.
I've been regretting owning for a long time now. I regret owning.
For a long time, he knew he was going to have to decide how to get that debt, that regret, off his shoulders. He had to make things better for his family.
You okay? It's okay? You want me to kiss it?
Last year, Calvin and Atiya decided they stopped paying the mortgage, they'd give up the house. Recently, the couple moved back into the same building where they used to rent. Grandmother's still on the next floor, rent is still $800. Calvin's mom still lives around the corner.
He's learning and maturing, so I am proud of that.
At first, Calvin felt like he was going backwards, losing the home. But now, he feels like he took a big step forward, going back to renting.
Back at the bottom of it, but I feel more comfortable being at the bottom of the stepping stone than where we were. I feel much more comfortable coming back here.
It was a costly lesson. Calvin and Atiya Sangster had to give up their own place in order to come home. In Boston, I'm Kurt Nickisch for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering long-term strategies built on experience and research. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, an observation about, well, frankly, I'm not sure what this says about A, consumers, B, Goldman Sachs, and C, BP, but here you go. The British market research firm YouGov is out with a new brand index, a measurement of how the public perceives certain brands, whether they've got a generally positive or negative impression. Right about here, you know where this is going, right? BP's reputation is bad. Goldman's is worse. There's a link to the graph showing you that via our friend Felix Salmon at Reuters. It's on our website, marketplace.org. And for now, on this Friday, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 38 points, a third of 1%. The NASDAQ up 24 points, about 1.1%. The S&P 500 up 3 points, about a third of 1%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Ure. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, Kurt Nickisch is back with another family and buyer's remorse.
You know, everyone thinks you buy a home and it's the cornerstone of being an adult in this economy. It doesn't seem that that's true.
Dream homes and rude awakenings. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here on Monday.
American Public Media. all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.